Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Kent Wascom, author of The New Inheritors. We'll also hear from Heather Veneziano, one of the editors and contributors to Gateway to New Orleans, Bayou St. John, 1708 to 2018. Kent Wascom is a New Orleans native who's the author of three novels in a continuing saga of the Woolsack family of the Gulf Coast. The first, Blood of Heaven, took place beginning in 1799, during the early days of westward expansion along the southern frontier. The second, Secessia, took place in Reconstruction-era New Orleans. His most recent, just out, is The New Inheritors, which brings us forward to 1914 and New Orleans and the Mississippi Gulf Coast. Kent Wascom, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Hi, Susan. Thanks for having me.
One of the things that fascinates me about this violent and fascinating family, the Woolsacks, is that you're really taking the long view. I remember, I think you originally envisioned this as a quartet, and now yes. It might be a sextet?
Well, actually, it's the reverse. The ambition had the better of me and was thinking of it as a sextet, but now it's sharpened into a quartet, so I'm starting the process of the last one, which is kind of bittersweet and daunting.
Oh, wow. Did you start off with the vision for many, many books? Did that make it easier or harder?
Well, the vision of the books themselves and kind of the inspiration to do a series or a set or a sequence or a cycle or whatever we're going to call it started when I was an undergrad at LSU. And I kind of haunted two parts of the library, I guess I would call it foreign literature, but of everything that's not English, you know, it's usually in one big row of stacks in the Louisiana history section. And because I had been born in New Orleans and my family lived on the North Shore and I grew up there for the first 5 years, but then primarily in Pensacola, Florida, and my mother's family is from the Mississippi Gulf Coast. So kind of always had a very definite sense of place and of being like from somewhere. And as a teenager, really desperately tried to claim New Orleans and all those things because, you know, what are you going to do when you're a teenager in Florida? Say, no, I'm not from here. Anyway, you know, as an undergrad and kind of getting ready to be out of school, I plucked this book off the shelf that was called The Story of the West Florida Republic. And it was a little chapbook that had been published in the 1930s. But the shape of that story and the story of this kind of brief, ill-starred little republic that was formed out of the Spanish colony of West Florida gave me a shape of identity that stretched what's now south of I-10 and I-12, but north of New Orleans and in Louisiana across the Gulf to Pensacola and was administrated alternately out of Pensacola and Baton Rouge and kind of suddenly said, oh, this is where I'm from. Fantastic.
But mine.
This is a spot. So now I can say, you know, what I am, or at least made it less amorphous. But then also at that time, I was reading lots and lots, but which anyone should who wants to be a writer, primarily fiction and translation, which I still do. It's most of what I read. And I came upon Yukio Mishima, a Japanese author, and his Sea of Fertility Tetralogy, which sort of chronicles the Japan of post-Russo-Japanese War all the way to the post-World War II period, and fell in love with that and that idea, this sequence of novels that, you know, can be read in order but could also be read singly, right? But as a whole or in concert, inform this broader thing. And just to have that space to work with is great because if you're burden to one voice. Like I would hate to have to stand solely on the voice in Blood of Heaven, right?
Of course,
the first
of
one, which starts with this, you know, really crazed screed of a preacher turned slaver. So yeah, having the set's been the ability to sort of build on this and not only build, but to contradict and question the visions of the earlier volumes, which mm-hmm. sort of mirror their times, too.
So fascinating to see them, all the woolsacks come along over time. So tell us about this new generation and who they are.
Well, it's a bit difficult to leap in, but...
It is. It's hard.
So sticking strictly to the familial ties, if we went the Blood of Heaven is Angel Woolsack, or the first Angel Woolsack, who comes to what was then Spanish West Florida, but became part of Louisiana and American Louisiana, the turn of the 19th century. By the second book, we're following his son and the circumstances around the Civil War in New Orleans. And by the third, by the New Inheritors, the person who was a young man in Secessia is older and has had children. And his children are about to start vying for not only their place in the world, but their, well, to not put too fine a point on it, their inheritance.
Exactly.
Thus the title. You can keep dropping it. But and it's three siblings. The oldest is Angel, named for the grandfather, who's, I mean, they would not have had the term at the time, but a closeted gay man, mm-hmm. but who has served his father throughout his life and is sort of his father's factotum in their predations in Latin America. And the family's sort of gone from basically speculation and investment, especially in slave trade, into, in the post-war period, the establishment of what was kind of derisively called banana republics.
Right.
Their course sort of parallels that of what became United Fruit. And others. So as Joseph Woolsack, who was a child in Secessia, begins to age and is losing his faculties and his ability to control his business empire, the oldest son and the middle son, Red, who's a bit unstable would be how I would describe him.
Yes.
Who's inherited quite a bit of the traits, or maybe the worst of the familial traits, they're in conflict with one another. And on the outside, them who's sort of removed, who might be the family's only hope for any redemptive qualities, is Kemper, the daughter, the Woolsacks, who's, of course, the novel is sort of setting herself apart from
the family legacy.
From the family. Yeah, exactly. And the question would be whether that's possible.
She is so amazing. She's such an amazing character. I love her. Now, in so much of this book, you're really writing about the Gulf Coast, and you write about it with such attentiveness and close observation. And I wondered if you'd read that little section about the landscape that sort of sets the tone for 1914 on the Gulf Coast.
Absolutely. It is coming in the warming water and the columns of the upper air, in the convergence of fronts and the tilting face of the sun. It is coming from the islands of the Cabo Verde west of Africa, where the trade winds, which once filled the sails of ships jammed with the captive and enslaved, make warlike commerce with other winds and form the beginnings of the storm. The hurricane, the god of the coast whose Passover is August and September, and which, before it was a god, was and remains a function of the earth's need to temper summer, a colossal cooling mechanism. Around these giants, the weight of the world shifts. The atmosphere thins to vacuum, and were you to stand at the right height in one's eye, you would be sucked skyward with the planet's hot updraft and dissolved among the mountainous clouds to fall as particles of rain. It is coming for them in the summer that begins with arrows and ends with the beginning of the Great War. And it has no name, the storms that will mark their coming together. For we did not always give names to storms and chart our expectations of them. Storms, like corporations, are only human in the intimacy of their destruction and the lives they mar. We can no more name the storm than we can hold the wind in our hands or know the nature of love. Try, and you will find your fingers clawing emptiness, the weight of the world gone, and nothing between you and the void.
Kent Wascom, you do foreboding like nobody's business. You just sit there and go, okay.
A lot of watching the clouds roll in and darken. But it's hard not to, right? It's getting toward that time of year.
It is. And, I know. This is the perfect book for this time of year.
For better or worse.
That's why it's on all the summer reading lists. So what is it like for you to slip into the voice of these novels? I mean, sometimes I imagine you sitting there talking to yourself.
That's a lot of times. There's quite a bit of talking to myself. Well, because the voices of the novels are pretty distinct.
Yes,
and
very.
And that's part of what I like also about at least the shape of the set and the nature of, or how I see it, mm-hmm. that each book has its own stylistic boundary as well as a temporal boundary.
And in this book, you step forward and directly address the reader on many occasions.
Yeah. This was a voice, I mean, they're all sort of stumbled into, and then you kind of, you hear it and go, yeah, that's the one, where, you know, Blood of Heaven is in first person and entirely bound within this deranged point of view.
scary angels, I gotta tell you. Very scary angels.
And the second one is very rich, florid, some might say purple, 19th century novel,
yes.
very much, or at least employing some of the techniques of the 19th century novel as refracted through Oates or Angela Carter, who are the big prose influences on that one. And with The New Inheritors, I wrote I don't know how many pages, different styles, different voices, different courses I was going towards. But when I hit on Isaac as a kind of central character, at least the fulcrum for the narrative, this voice came, and it was, yeah, it's a voice that sort of takes the reader by the lapels.
Yes, it does.
And I like it. Also because usually, you know, part of being a writer is hiding behind another voice and or, you know, and inhabiting it and doing all those things. And this is, you know, to do the writer thing. Like, it's not me who's doing it, but it's like, of course it is, who's doing the lapel grabbing. And I don't know, in both the cultural and political and environmental sense, we're in such a precarious time that, and I'm writing about a precarious time as well,
yes.
and the impact that the actions of that time have on our own. So I kind of felt the need to make that direct address.
Mm-hmm.
And it gives you a lot of leeway. And a lot of leeway in leaping through time, which I do a bit more of. But also, yeah, that moment, which is kind of a challenge. Either the reader goes like, oh, yeah, thanks for, you know, giving me a shake. Or like, okay, hands off, sir.
You talking to me?
Enough. I mean, yeah, right. I don't like being spoken to in that tone of voice.
Now, in addition to all this family drama and competition, there are several great love stories in this book. And one of the characters Kemper Woolsack falls in love with is Isaac Patterson, who was inspired by Walter Anderson,
yes.
the real-life artist.
Certainly, and kind of a confluence of several people, but
yes.
definitely the original impetus. And Walter Anderson, who lived much later, or at least was active about 20 years later.
But would have been possible at that
yeah,
time.
Yeah, sure.
He
was born.
Exactly.
But, and there's two distinct moments, mm-hmm. which I won't reveal because one of them is sort of penultimate.
Yes,
but that were lifted directly and are also, by the way, just a shout out to a fabulous book, are rendered as well in Jack Davis's book, The Gulf.
Right.
Which is a masterpiece and all of you should go read it. But because this book is so much about, like the other ones, about history, mm-hmm. right, and what we inherit from both family and nation and how we view that, right, the text of the Blood of Heaven, their ancestors' literal gospel, becomes their origin myth.
Right, a family and, with a book.
Exactly. They're literally a people of the book. And it's unquestioned, at least by the male siblings at first.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also a novel about, very, very, very much about, as you pointed out, landscape and environment and our very precarious environment that we live in. And Anderson and his life and his fascination with and fealty to the Gulf and to the natural world was incredibly inspiring and kind of tried from line one to imbue Isaac with that as much as I could.
Yes. So much is swirling around, you know, the war, the hurricane of 1915, mm-hmm. the changing politics of the time, and then the standard family drama, the great love stories. And there are many great love stories in this book. You always have several great love stories,
Thank you. I must say.
It's just fascinating because you pack so much in and it's much shorter.
Yeah, they're shrinking. And they're also changing color.
Yes, they are.
So they went from red and black to blue and white. And I don't know what that says about me. But yeah, the idea of compression, which for someone who loves a ropey sentence, and I love a long sentence and a sonorous sentence and a euphonous sentence, being able to sort of whittle and whittle and whittle it down to where you can still have this complex structure and this big, big, big sentence or a paragraph that's, you know, two sentences. Mm-hmm. But managing that, or let's say balancing that with extreme clarity and control, and having that big authorial voice, or at least I felt like it gave me more control, mm-hmm. to where I could, instead of just this kind of beautiful image that takes up, or a moment that takes up a sentence or two, a long sentence or two, I could take a life and sort of see if I can, you know, rarefy that into one motion.
Oh, well, I love this book.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Kent Wascom, whose grand new novel is The New Inheritors. You can meet him Tuesday, July 10th at 6 at Octavia Books. Kent, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
One of the most eagerly awaited books of the summer is Gateway to New Orleans, Bayou St. John, 1708 to 2018, sponsored by the Louisiana Landmark Society. It's edited by Mary Louise Kristovich, Florence Jumonville, and Heather Veneziano. The excellent essays are by Hilary Irvin, Stephanie Bruno, Heather Veneziano, and Fred Starr, with photography by Robert and Jan Brantley. It's a real pleasure today to speak with writer and editor Heather Veneziano. Heather, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you, Susan. Happy to be here.
Now, you're representing a lot of people here today, so tell us about this great project and how you got involved with it.
I first got involved back in the early fall, but the majority of the group had already been brought on by Mary Lou in early spring of 2016. So at that point, she decided to revisit this book. She had put off her research in 1982 that she began in 1980. So this was really a time for her to finish this project that was so important to her. So she initially recruited Stephanie Bruno, who she brought in Hilary Irvin. And then Mary Lou started formulating who she wanted to be working on this book. So my involvement started when she realized that with so many people, she's going to need somebody to help manage everyone and all the work coming in. She brought me on initially as the project manager and to help her with the design of the book. And then eventually my role expanded to include the editing with Florence and writing my chapter.
Well, tell us about your chapter for starters.
My chapter explores early exploration of the area and then the colonization of the area. So its Bayou St. John neighborhood predates the city of New Orleans by 10 years. So the first concessions were granted in 1708, which Mary Lou really wanted this book to come out for the tricentennial, because a lot of the issues surrounding the tricentennial mark New Orleans being 300 years old. And she always took issue with that because Bayou St. John, 1708. So for her, having it come out this year, and that's why this book has such a tight deadline, because she was adamant about it coming out in 2018.
Mary Lou was very strict.
She was.
You know?
She got things accomplished, though.
She did.
She definitely did. The amount of work she accomplished in her life is astounding to me.
So it's an important tribute to her legacy that we have this book.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Throughout the last months of her life, she made us all promise multiple times, this will get done, right? You promise me it will get done. So she had our promise and we were able to get it done for her, which I'm really happy about.
So tell us about some of the other writers who've contributed to this book.
Richard Campanella, who we're so happy to have on board, he contributed the preface for the book. Fred Starr did the historical overview. Hilary Irvin did an architectural survey of the neighborhood, which is very in-depth and covers quite a bit of information and houses. And Stephanie Bruno contributed roughly 100 houses for the photo index.
There's an astonishing amount of material in this book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you live in Bayou St. John, you're going to look for your house first thing, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. I mean, so. And it'll probably be in there, considering
so,
how many
we
have in there.
It makes me wonder if people know their houses are in this book. Do they?
I think so many people got introduced to the book through Robert Brantley wandering around the neighborhood taking photos.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people during that time period when they saw him out front, they would get into conversation with him. And they were also pleased to find out that perhaps their house was going to be focused on in the book. So the majority of houses within the parameters of Broad to the west side of Moss and Orleans to Esplanade are included. And those are the historic parameters of Faubourg St. John. Mm-hmm. So that's what the book mainly focuses on. But we had a tough time for space in the book. We didn't want to have to cut any houses that we wrote about. So it's pretty chock full of information and houses, which is a great thing. It was just very challenging given the timeline of the book to get it all included.
So there's so much diverse architecture represented in this book. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the kinds of houses you see in Bayou St. John and why they're so important.
You have houses spanning hundreds of years in Bayou St. John. It's a really interesting neighborhood architecturally. It's very different from a lot of the city because a lot of the tracks were built upon early and then either demolished or changed. And then kind of as the neighborhood grew out from Moss Street, you see different periods bringing different kinds of architectural styles into the neighborhood, but they all kind of blend really well. Mm-hmm. So you'll have craftsman bungalows with some Victorian era shotguns, but everything, if you look at it as you're walking around, it is really like a village neighborhood. So everything kind of goes along nicely with each other.
Until I read this book, I had never seen the word bungaloid used as an adjective, which I just love.
Uh-huh. That's a Mary Lou.
I know, it's really kind of great.
A lot of times when we're sitting in front of her computer with Florence, towards the end especially, because she knew she had limited time left and she really wanted to do as much as she could for the book. Mm-hmm. So we would sit and just have marathon computer sessions where she would say, what would you call this? What would you call this? Go get this book from downstairs in my library so you could see what they called it. So the vocabulary used in the book was really thought out fairly well by Mary Lou, and every word mattered.
Well, that was one of my favorite words, mm-hmm. I have to say. And I love the way in Bayou St. John you have an East Bank and a West Bank. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a wonderful way to organize this book, I think. Mm-hmm. Now, so many people think of Bayou St. John as really the heart of the city. What is it you think makes people love this neighborhood so much? I mean, we're all fierce in love of our neighborhoods in New Orleans, but Bayou St. John in particular.
It is the heart of the city, really. It's the lifeline of the city, and it had been the lifeline for the city for so many years. It kind of cemented that reputation for it. I think visually it's a stunning neighborhood with the waterways and the active life on them, which is consistent throughout the year. We have Bayou Boogaloo. We have different festivals happening. It's a living neighborhood, and I think it draws a lot of people in that don't even necessarily live there, but just to visit for the recreational purposes. So it means a lot to a lot of people. I'm always fascinated when people don't realize the provenance of the neighborhood and how old it is and how important to the founding of the city it is. And they just love it because of what they personally experienced there as opposed to the history. So
now, one of the things I love about this book is that you have gone to so much trouble to depict the life here. Mm-hmm. You know, there the rowing club, the parks, the churches, and Magnolia Bridge, which is such a beloved landmark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we tried to include many of them. We have a church focused on in the book. Hillary Irvin goes into a lot of details about the Southern Rowing Club and a few other clubs that were active in the neighborhood. But it's always been a center, a neighborhood center for people.
People lived in houseboats on Bayou St. John, which I think is so fascinating.
There was. Richard and Fred touch upon that briefly. I wish that we had a multi-volume just of this book so we can cover so much more in it because we don't have a ton about the houseboats, but we do have a historic photograph from the Library of Congress representing them.
Yes.
It's interesting to see the one houseboat pictured looks kind of like a shotgun, a single shotgun.
It does.
So how the waterway architecture kind of mirrors the land-based, and the same styles are transferred.
So who do you see as the ideal reader for this book? I mean, is it somebody who lives in Bayou St. John? Is it an architect? What does a preservationist like yourself look for in a book like this?
For me personally, I think having all the archival information that's presented in the book is so valuable. Hillary and Stephanie both went through such a long process of gaining title research and really focusing on the entire history of each house that they looked into. I think also anyone who lives in the neighborhood, of course, but it tells a story of the founding of New Orleans. So it kind of opens it up to a broader audience through that and through the neighborhood's historical importance.
So tell me about your life as a writer before you got involved in this project.
I had wrote quite a bit for Preservation in Print magazine. I was just the interim editor there. Prior to that, my main body of work focuses on architectural research and cemetery preservation. I actually met Mary Lou in St. Louis No. 2 Cemetery, where a lot of her work began. So this was interesting for me because of the architecture, but also learning more about how the neighborhood was shaped and being able to write about houses that maybe I wouldn't have looked at beforehand.
Well, it's just such a life of observing and noting. You know, it's just, that's what we want in New Orleans. We've been talking with Heather Veneziano, one of the editors and contributing writers to Gateway to New Orleans, Bayou St. John, 1708 to 2018. You can meet her, along with other contributors, Thursday, July 12th at 6 at Octavia Books. Heather, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Kent Wascom discusses and signs The New Inheritors, Tuesday, July 10th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Garden District Bookshop Book Club discusses The Leavers by Lisa Coe, Wednesday, July 11th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Contributors and editors Florence Jumonville, Hillary Somerville Irvin, and Stephanie Bruno discuss and sign The Gateway to New Orleans, Bayou St. John, 1708 to 2018, Tuesday, July 10th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Contributors and editors Florence Jumonville, Heather Veneziano, Hillary Somerville Irvin, and photographer Robert Brantley discuss and sign The Gateway to New Orleans, Bayou St. John, 1708 to 2018, Thursday, July 12th at 6 at Octavia Books. Sarah Ann Harris discusses and signs The Dance Halls of Spanish Louisiana, Thursday, July 12th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Paul French signs City of Devils, The Two Men Who Rule the Underworld of Old Shanghai, Friday, July 13th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Octavia Books Science Fiction Book Club discusses Lovecraft Country by Matt Ruff, Saturday, July 14th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Connie Morgan signs her children's book, The Runaway Beignet, Saturday, July 14th at 2:30 at Octavia Books. Lexi Ostro signs A Heavenly Kind of Love, Sunday, July 15th at 2 at Garden District Bookshop. Bill Lofelm signs the paperback of The Devil's Muse, and William Boyle signs The Lonely Witness, Monday, July 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Kim Vaz DeVille celebrates the release of Walking Ratty, The Baby Dolls of New Orleans, Sunday, July 22nd at 2 at the Xavier University Administration Building. And coming up August 4th at the East Bank Regional Library, the Tricentennial Literary Festival. Save the date. And here's a shout out to University of New Orleans alumna and master's candidate Shayna Monet, just named the recipient of the prestigious Iowa Review Award in Poetry. Her poems will be published in the forthcoming issue of the Iowa Review, and she will receive a prize of $1,500. Bravo! Join us for the Tricentennial Reading List every Tuesday at 8:44 a.m. and 5:44 p.m. The Tricentennial Reading List is brought to you by the Hellas Foundation, the John Burton Harter Trust, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.